Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hi, this is Ryan Fraser.
This is Troy Deeney.
This is Gus Boyett.
This is Don Hutchison.
This is Jurgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jurgen. I travel to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast wouldn't happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to join us, to become a socio, and to get every interview we produce without adverts, and before it goes out on the main feed, plus lots of bonus content, including the chance to put questions to our guests, and to me, via the monthly Q&A. You will also get bonus content every month, including the audio versions of my regular columns for ESPN. So do please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter and join the club, and get your family and friends to do so. Maybe even strangers in the street. Love you. Back to the big interview with me, Graham. Or welcome for the first time. My guest today is Alan McInally, Air United, Celtic, Aston Villa, Bayern Munich, and Scotland. Over two episodes in this podcast, we will mostly focus on the last three teams in that list. Today, Villa. Graham Taylor, funny stories. David Platt, Gordon Cowans, give me more Sid Cowans stories, please, guests. The Garys, Shaw and Thompson. His spectacular goal against Millwall and a breakdown of his most difficult opponent, the Bear, who man-marked him during 18 holes in the Canadian countryside. Yes, I do mean a bear. Listen, this is Rambo. He's very informative, very funny, but I believe he's going to show a football mind very different from his easygoing, happy-go-lucky personality that the TV thrives on. This is a guy who knew his football, played at a very high level, and tells it brilliantly too. You're going to enjoy this. Listeners, it's the big interview again. Well, as always, I'm not going to claim it's the first time, but I'm overcome with excitement because as you grow older, you get over the fact that some of your guests have come to Pittodrie and thumped one in the net from about 25 metres after beating six men. And on that day, I wouldn't have agreed to the big interview with Alan McInally, but given that he turned out to be easily a European-class footballer, somebody that Scotland could have been very proud of if his career had been extended at international level. Somebody who did what I admire very much in life, which is back himself, back his talent and experiment with life in Europe. That means that today we've got the privilege of welcoming Alan McInally, esteemed Sky pundit, but excellent, excellent Scottish striker to the big interview. Al, good morning. Thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome. Good to see you, buddy.
I want every guest to come out of this feeling that they've enjoyed the football chat. And I know that talking about football is something that you don't just do for a living. Like me, you're a bit of an addict. But I want to start with golf. And a tale you told me after giving me a tip that was worth about $2,500 for that brilliant Cheltenham Festival meeting. And my memory's not what it used to be. Either you or a friend was chased by a great big grizzly bear on the third tee of a... I already can see from your face that I've struck home. Give us like hazards should in golf should be heather, bracken, rocks, water, just in front of the green, but not 6 foot two grizzly. Tell it your way, big man.
Right, well, my missus is Canadian, and we're based in Calgary. And there's a place in Panorama, which is actually British Columbia, so it's out of Alberta. But it's in the mountains, and it is the most gorgeous place you've ever been into in your life. Lots to do, whitewater rafting, but there's a golf course there called Wolf Creek. And it's in the trees, and it's just, Graham, it's just beautiful. It's one of my favourite ever places. And we get to the third tee, and we're in the buggy. And I'd said to the boy before, he said, what'd you play off? I said, 4 or 5. He went, that's pretty good. I said, can I play off the back sticks? He went, yeah. He said, there's a couple of them being redone. He says, but, you know, play as far back as you want, because I thought, I'm going to try and test myself a little bit here. Anyway, so I drive up the top of the hill to the back tee at the third, and you're kind of quite high up, and there's a ranger sitting in a buggy. And I went, hey, how you doing? He went, hey, man, how you doing? You know, are you enjoying the course? And I'm like, absolutely. Oh, you're from Scotland? I mean, yeah, yeah, no problem. And I went, that's good. I said, you can watch me, watch this. I've split the fairway. He went, I ain't watching you, buddy. I'm like, oh, fair enough. I was just trying to be nice. He went, I'm watching him. And I turned around and I was like, and there was this bear, this black, wasn't it a grizzly or a brown bear? This black bear. Now, to be fair, he was still probably be about 150 yards away. But he was, Graham, he was right there. He was right there sitting down, looking right towards the tee. And I was thinking, oh my God, I've seen a bear, but I've never seen a bear like, I'm going to eat you. I've never seen that bear. And my heart was pounding. Super. And I was thinking, unbelievable. He went, don't worry about it. He said, he ain't interested in you. And I thought, and I was, it was the most exhilarating feeling I'd had since, I don't know, scoring a goal. But he was beautiful. He was just magnificent. And the guy said, look, he's fine. He's all right. There's three of them out here. Just be careful. Just be careful when you go and get your ball. And I was like, oh my God. And I suppose as beautiful as Canada is, it has certain, you know, things in it that you just genuinely have to be careful. And ever since then, I've carried bear spray when I go and get a pint of milk.
There's been many stories of performing bears, and all you really needed was for the bear to shout, oh, big man, use an iron.
I know, exactly.
Talk to the driver.
Yeah, it was, I said, hi, Mike and Ali, you'll never hit the fairway anyway.
allow me an abandoned meander before we start on the football, because I think I knew about Canada, but I didn't know about Calgary. And if I'm not wrong, Calgary has a great history of, if it's not like performing horses, or it was where the shows were, the Rhinestone Cowboys, where Calgary is a...
Yeah, it's called the Calgary Stampede. It's 3 weeks a year, and it is the horse capital of the world, basically. It's the cowboy capital of the world, just about, and it's where all the bronco riders come and all the bull riders come, and they have the wagon races, and it's to go to it, it's spectacular. Really dangerous, and I mean dangerous, but you're right, Graham, spectacular place and proper cowboy country.
No joking at all. Do you feel, I mean, never mind having a punt, do you, when I go to the races, when I watch horses, I don't claim any knowledge, but I do always go to the parade ring, and it's the way you describe the bear. I watch horses close up, and they're unbelievable, because if all you've ever done is watch horses on the television, can they go fast, can they jump this wall at Hickstead, you go close to horses, and maybe you are a co-owner, I don't know if you've ever actually, and I've been on one or two, I've taken some lessons, but boy, when you see thoroughbred racehorses in their prime, the elegance, the power, the grace, and you get a feeling of being close to something truly special in nature when you're around horses.
Oh, I am so fortunate when you talk about horses, in terms of one of my best friends is Peter Scudamore, who was an ex-champion jockey. And I've known the boys, both Michael and Thomas, since they were kids. I don't spend a lot of time on horses, that would be a lie, but in terms of being with Scoo, and Scoo saying, hold this, and I'm holding it, and the thing's giving it all that, and I'm like, Scoo, I'm telling you now, if this thing runs, I'm letting it go. He went, it won't. But it's the physical, this huge power that, And a lot of people, you're right, will watch it on the telly, but until you stand and sort of completely right next to a racehorse, you've no idea. One of my best stories I ever tell Scoo was he was riding out. He was assistant trainer to Nigel Tristan Davis. And he's like, come on, get up in the morning. I'm like, it's 10 past 7, Scoo. We've been in for 4 hours, by the way. He says, come on, down in the gallops and watch these horses. So I was like, right, okay. So there was me, I'm going to say, I think Mark McGee might have been with me, and Maurice Johnston. And we're down at the bottom. And this huge, huge black horse, it was humongous. And it is jumping and pulling and tugging. And Scoo's on top. I'll stand up for this. Scoo's on top and he's holding the reins. And there's a huge steep hill where they climb to train, and they run the horses up and down on this artificial turf. And Scoo's like that, by the way. He's like, seriously, 3 stone went through. And he was sitting on it, and he went, and he's talking to us, and this thing's going, and I'm like, I don't like this. And he just went like that, opened his hands, and the horse started to move, and Scoo sat motionless to the top of the hill. And I thought, oh my God, that is the scariest thing I've ever seen, but the most powerful gracefulness of this animal with a professional jockey who could have sat on anything that made any moves. It was just unbelievable. From that day on, he's always been a top man to me, Scoo, but my realism of the danger of going anywhere near a racehorse is something that I certainly won't need to be doing and never will be doing, by the way.
I want to invent a time machine, Alan, and because there are two things on my mind right now. A lot of people, I think the audience, we've had about 15 million listens across our life, and a lot of the audience won't have seen you play live. About 50-50 will have. So for those that didn't, I don't simply want them to remember you as a good football analyst and commentator on Sky. I'd like you to take a time machine and take you back to Aston Villa. It's all very well that they're doing good now, that they have some footballers in their ranks. Last time I was at Aston Villa's training ground, it was with Gary Mack, and Gary was assistant coach at the time, and he took us out to the training ground, and the American owner had invested in it, and he said that this pitch is, it's cost $1 million, it's exactly the same as at Villa Park, and I've been at Villa Park for semi-finals, for league matches. And I want you to take us to your first arrival at Aston Villa training, your first match, the sensation of being in Birmingham, which for all the power of second city is not, even for Scots, it's not the most glamorous or exciting city that calls out to you. Take us back to your first week at Villa, the sights, the sounds, the impressions, and whether there was even the merest butterfly in your stomach.
I still get butterflies before you go on television because there's a rush of adrenaline, and also as a football player back then. I mean, I can remember I stayed in the Midland Hotel, which is right in the centre of Birmingham, and it was next to the new street station, literally just around the corner from there. I don't even know if it's still there, the Midland Hotel. And I went a walk. We trained in the morning, and I didn't have a car down there at the time, and we were getting club cars. Not that you'd ever drive your car in Birmingham anyway. But I got a lift from Steve Harrison, who was Graham Taylor's assistant, and dropped me at the hotel. So that's me at the hotel now, until I get picked up in the morning to bring me to training at Bodymore Heath. And I went for a walk around Birmingham. Birmingham's massive, by the way. And it's busy and it's noisy. Not that Glasgow wasn't, but Glasgow's a different atmosphere. Glasgow's a different person. There's an atmosphere in Glasgow that you'll never get in any other city. And Birmingham's a little bit the same. But never did I think I was in the wrong place. And never did I think that, not an anxious way. I was just thinking, can't wait for training to start tomorrow. I'll probably eventually know where I'm going in this place. And I was just biting and bubbling to go. And literally had a couple of pints. I had a couple of pints back in the hotel. I wasn't a big drinker as a football player. I'd like a wee glass of champagne, but I wasn't a big beer drinker or something. Early to bed. And was literally in reception waiting to get picked up to go to training. I'm that excited in terms of what was going to do. And when I got there was the likes of, you know, Gordon Cowans and David Platt and Alan Evans and Nigel Spink, Gary Thompson, brilliant big guy, brilliant in the air, really strong, great, you know, foil for me. The two of us played up top together, immediately had a brilliant relationship together, still have with the big man, and we laugh and we joke about loads of things that we did and experienced and with the success we had in the football club. But that was what I was looking forward to my very first week at Aston Villa, as well as knowing that Graham Taylor had said, I've been trying to buy him for 3 or 4 years and he wouldn't come to Watford twice. And now I've got the opportunity to have him at Aston Villa. And I was like, Celtic were a bit nonplussed at the time, whether I stayed or whether I went. And Brian McLaren had already gone to Manchester United. Maurice Johnson had gone to Nantes in France. And it left me as the lone striker. And Billy McNeil, who was the manager at the time, who had just come in, funnily enough, had said, look, I'm bringing Frank McAvaney. And I said, well, that's brilliant. I said, give me the same money Frank's getting and I'm happy to stay. And he went, oh, okay, leave it with me. And eventually, I don't know what Frank was getting. I've not really spoke to Frank about it. But he only offered me a 2-year contract. And I was like, nah, you don't care whether I stay or whether I go. And every time I spoke to Graham Taylor, you know, I'd scored the winning World Cup goal every time I spoke to him. He wanted me that much. So I thought, okay. And if and you'll remember this, Graham, back in the time, how many times did someone say about a player in Scotland, he'd be brilliant in England, he'd be really good in England? And then obviously you've got the likes of Kenny Dalglish and Stevie Nicol and Alan Hansen and Joe Jordan and Gordon McQueen and all these brilliant Scottish football players, Arthur Alberston and the whole shooting match, Stevie Archibald, all
hey,
these
Stevie.
Unbelievable players, and you think, yeah, it's time to go, Al. Time to spread the wings. And obviously my father was a football player, a very famous football player my father was. Won the league title in 64, 65 with Kilmarnock. So in that area of Ayrshire, everybody knew Jackie McAnally and kind of expected his son, Alan McAnally, to be a football player. But whether they expected me to spread my wings this far, I would doubt it. But I just thought, this is the time. This is the time I need to make a big decision. And this is the time where I need to make sure, when you do leave Scotland and you leave a club like Glasgow Celtic, by the way, you better be doing it for the right reasons, and you better doing it for a position to put yourself, if you're going to become the best, to make sure you do become the best of what you can be.
And Jackie and Kilmarnock, when they won that title, had marvellous European adventures, took some gigantic scalps, and I guess either he showed you, taught you, or you inherited a sense of adventure, a sense of, you know, my horizons are not just what I can see.
Yeah. My mum wasn't happy. You're always your mammy's boy, ain't you? She was like, whatever, but my dad's like, ah, right, Avril, let him go. And I did. And the good thing is, Graham, the first season, see, the problem with going for Aston Villa was they had been relegated.
Yeah.
Now I'm coming from Glasgow Celtic playing in Europe to a huge football team, incidentally, that had certainly lost its way, but had invested in players to get promotion immediately back to the top flight. And the good news is, touch wood, that's exactly what we did. We simply battered teams. So we won, like, I don't know, 12, 13 away games or something that season. And, you know, we're just so strong at Aston Villa. And the stadium itself, there was players arrived. There was teams were arriving at Villa Park beat before they even, you know, saw Gary Thompson and I running out. So that was a huge advantage, and we had a really good atmosphere within the lads. Gordon Cowans was just, what a football player Sid was. Again, 3 stone wet through, just unbelievable. And if he would say to me, right, we'd work on things, you know, if you're coming towards me, if you only take 4 or 5 steps, I know you're going to turn and I'm going to put it right over the top. And then we get in behind teams. And then Mark Walters, how can I forget Wally? Mark Walters on the left-hand side, bombing in the back post. I mean, we had just fabulous times, and it was really good.
Let's take them one by one. Let's take them one by one because I want detail. Start with the manager, Graham Taylor. For those who don't pay attention fully, that documentary when he was the England manager puts him in a certain pigeonhole. But the guy that I watched making Watford, you know, more successful and interesting than they'd ever been before. A guy who in Paris, I was at the 2006 Champions League final, and as is my wont, I was out all night. And I was on the breakfast show on Radio 5 with Nicky Campbell, and I was supposed to pitch up in this cafe in Paris at 7 a.m. to be on air, and I come straight from going, and Nicky Campbell took a look at me in the news break too, and have you been out all night? And I was like, no. And Graham Taylor was the other guest, and Graham went, no, Nicky, it's fine. He's in my hotel. I saw him in his bed about midnight and just piped up. What kind of man did you find there? Did you get on? Did his lust for Alan McInally, the footballer, continue as you worked together?
Yeah. He was like a second dad to me. He was hard on me, Graham. Boy, was he hard. We were 2-0 up at half-time at West Ham, at the good old Upton Park. I wish they'd never moved from that ground, West Ham. Old Upton Park, 2-0 up, finishes the game, we draw 2-2, come in at full-time. You, Scottish, do me a favour. 2 goals and you chuck it. I'm like, hang on a minute. He went, you don't start, just get in the bath, get in the shower. Seriously, all the other players are like that. Nobody speaks to Alan McInally like that. Nobody speaks to the big man. He's like, you're not Martin Keown, not Alan Evans, not Nigel Smith. We just conceded 2 goals. But because I didn't get a hat-trick, because we didn't get one more goal, it was my fault. And then he'd be like, something like, I can have a go at you. I can't have a go at them. You know, that kind of thing. I'm hard on you because I know it won't affect you. You're not going to bust out crying. It's going to make you harder and stronger and better. And then three weeks later it was, we had, you know, the fitness tests that all the lads get now. You had the beat test and you've got the stamina test and the build-up test, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it was we were in Wednesday morning. No game in the Wednesday night. And we did crossing and finishing, nothing too drastic. And then Steve Harrison pulls me and says, but the gaffer wants to see you at 2:30, 3 o'clock. I'm like, okay. He said, we're back training. And I was like, Wednesday afternoon, fine. So I literally turned to Gary Thompson and I said, you back in this afternoon? He went, nope.
Ooh.
I went, what? I said, Platy, are you back this afternoon? He went, no. I said, he wants me back at 2:30. I'm like, I don't get this. So I have my lunch. I don't even go back to Lichfield where I was staying. I actually stayed, I put my head down. Just at the corner of the fitness room, had half an hour kept back in. Everything's washed and cleaned and thing. There's a pair of training shoes, my training shoes with number 9, and training gear. Everything else is all spotlessly clean. Just one set of training gear. I'm like, I don't know what the hell's going on here. So, 2 hours 59 minutes. The door opens. Chat. Right, come on, let's go. Graham Taylor. With a whistle around his neck, a time watch, and all of his training gear. Right, come on, let's go. So out we go. Out the gates at Bodymore Heath, onto the road, onto the A38, cross the A38, right? And it's close to where the Belfry golf club is. And there's loads of farm roads and all that. So he says, right, come on, we're going for a farm run. Build your stamina up. I've got 18 goals at the time. It's only the middle of October. Anyway, he says, right, blow the whistle. You're going to go as hard as you can. And when you hear me blow the whistle, go back down to your jog. So I'm like, fair enough. So he says, on you go. So I set off away and leave him in his own. And then in the distance, about 2 minutes, I hear. So I slow down to your jog. And I'm looking back and I'm thinking, I'm in the middle of freaking nowhere here, but I don't even know where I am. I've not been in these farm roads. And then here he comes, jogging, catches me up.
So I'm going up and down.
Yeah. Well done, son. Well done. Right, you ready? Have you got your breath back? I'm like, yeah. He says, right. Then we start, like you know, just a bit Saturday's game and who we were playing and all that. He says, right, here we go again. On you go. And you can stop when you hear me blow this whistle. So I thought, I went out like a bat out of hell. Honestly, I must have been the other side of Birmingham. And I hear, I'm a mile and a half away at this point. I've booted this. I'm thinking, he's never catching me. I'm almost back all the way around, back at the training centre. And then I'm like that, and I'm thinking, and I honestly, God, it's 15 minutes, he's not caught me up yet. I've gone that hard. I am breathing out of every orifice you can possibly breathe out of. And eventually arrives, like, you know, well done, son. Brilliant. And then we go to a walk and we start talking about football and how he loved Lincoln City and how he used to pretend he was Johnny Hayes and crossing the ball in and that kind of thing. And about my mum and dad, about thinking about the players and about, you know, the team and about Alan Evans, who was the captain at the time, you know, and, you know, just football and just being friendly and all that. And I've forgotten. I've just done 4.5 mile. And the only reason he brought me out was A, for company, and B, he wanted to go for a run because there's nothing to do with me. So we get back to Bodymore. I swear to God, we get back to Bodymore Heath. Washed and changed, into the car, home. Brilliant son. Absolutely fantastic. Look forward, blah, blah, blah. Come in the morning, right? Walking on the corner. All right, gaffer. Hardly a word. Hardly a word. As though I'm the manager now again of Aston Villa. But he was brilliant. I mean, he was absolutely brilliant. I would have run through a wall for the man.
I'm here to tell you about another podcast. Yes, we believe in biodiversity. It's from the makers of The Big Interview, and it's called Between the Lines, the stories behind great sports writing. Every episode takes a classic sports book or outstanding piece of sports writing and examines how the writer crafted their story. This is a weekly show, and the series so far has featured documentaries on The Miracle of Castel di Sangro and Andrea Pirlo's autobiography, I Think, Therefore I Play. There's also interviews with writers like Henry Winter, Simon Cooper, Andy Mitten, and David Goldblatt. This is Tim Parks on his classic tome, A Season with Verona.
The Bishop of Verona invited the citizens of Verona to burn the book because I'd put all the blasphemies in it. So that was obviously good for sales. You know, I was very, very pleased about that. I wish they'd done it. It would have been a happy memory. On the Cordoba, I would go to games. There would be loads of kids coming up to me saying, you know, I've never read a book before, but I really enjoyed this.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You were a footballer who I thought you were multi-dimensional. If the ball was put over your shoulder and into the timing of a run, like we'll come to Sid in a minute, if the ball was coming in from wide, meet and drink for you, you could obviously hold it and turn. You could play as a nine, in my view, but you could also play, because I remember Gary first at Coventry, I'd have thought that more often Gary would have slightly taken up the nine position, you more often maybe around him. Was Graham's beliefs in how football should be played quite useful to your skill set? Because it wasn't all long and direct, but he quite liked the central strikers to be fed quite a lot and from both wide and from over the top onto your runs.
You'd be amazed if you think that Graham Taylor was a long ball merchant, considering he had David Platt, Stuart Gray, Gordon Cowans, you know, players like that, they can play the ball in the middle of the park. Yeah, real proper football players. But you could all run. I didn't play with my back to goal an awful lot. I wasn't really till I went to Germany that there was a couple of times where literally I played with my back to the goal as my own up top, and we would play players in front of me, and it was basically about then getting in behind. For Gary and I, as a pair, he liked us to work as a pair. But he also liked us to be, certainly Gary was the one, the more of the one, and I think the big man would probably agree that he was more stationary in terms of where he would be in the box. He wanted me to be involved, if I could, as much as I possibly could. But he always wanted the balls to end up in these wider areas and get into the box and get midfield players into the box, which means if the ball came into the box and I wasn't in the box, he used to go mental. He used to also say to me, and I've said this to kids, not so much kids, but I had a lovely little spell at Kilmarnock when Tommy Burns was the manager, and I was coaching the under-18s and 19s, and I would say to the strikers, three shots in the first half, three shots in the second half. You watch now when you watch a football match. Harry Kane does it. Ashley Barnes tries to do it. I'm trying to think of players. You watch how many times a centre-forward has a shot on target, which means then, A, I'm being direct, B, I've tried to hit the target, and if I get three shots in the first half, I'll try and do the same in the second half, and you never know, I might score. But rather than pass the buck, he didn't like passing the buck. He went, you got a chance to shoot, shoot. I don't care if you're 30 yards away. We'll deal with the problem. But then again, you have to notice, this is not really, I should be shooting from 30 yards here. I should be playing the ball here and getting in the box. But if there was an opportunity for you to shoot, he's like, three shots in the first half, three shots in the second half. And I'd come off the thing and be like, how many did you get? And I'd be like, God, I've forgotten already. He went, you had one shot. Yeah. I'm like, did I? And all of a sudden, you go out onto the pitch the next game or any time, even in training, and you think, right. So all of a sudden, as a centre-forward and a striker, as much as I know I've got a job to do with the team and get the ball into wide areas and take players on and use my pace and really be strong, on top of that, I've got, you had a shot, yeah. So all of a sudden, your mind's like, hang on a minute. So now you're being really aggressive in terms of trying to make something happen.
He's changed your psychology. With the smallest of little implants in your brain, he's changed your psychology.
Teeny, teeny wee things. And it's sometimes, you know, in big games, it's sometimes hard to do. But if you've got a mindset of trying to get shot on target without being overly greedy, then I think it's a good thing for players, certainly in my position, to have that kind of thing, you know. And it's picking the right time, when to do it, when not to do it. And that, again, you know, heightens the senses when you're playing games. You said at the very top, you know, I took a chance, I went and broadened my horizons. You did the same, girl. You went to Barcelona, you went to Spain, speak a new language, new watching new football, completely different culture. You've watched Messi. How many shots does he have?
Well, I'll tell you three stats then. One, if he can get a shot away, and more than that, he's building to a shot every time he's in a certain area. And if he has to skip past three, he'd normally have six or seven shots at goal or in for him on goal every game for the last 15 years.
Correct. So, by the way, and under no circumstances am I thinking I'm Lionel Messi, by the way. I'm just saying, in terms of a psychological way,
concept.
And Messi's actually, when Messi used to give the ball into somebody, right? More often than not, whoever's getting that ball's like, how the hell do I get it back to him? Because he's only giving it to me because he's going to have a shot at target.
That's right. I'm his wall. Put it in the feet. There's just a three-foot putt into his path and onto his left foot, and you've done your job.
Unbelievable. And that's what Graham Taylor helped me in terms of goal scoring. And I didn't even have a great goal scoring record, to be quite honest with you. And probably would have had a good finish had I not been injured and my career had finished. But my time at Aston Villa, in terms of where I was as a Celtic football player to an Aston Villa football player, well, the bottom line is, I would never have been even remotely on Bayern Munich's radar had it not been for Graham Taylor. That's how much he was important to me as a footballer.
It's a great testimony, and it's lovely to round out the character for those who might only encounter him on videos of his tough time with England. You mentioned Sid Cairns, and I'm grateful to you because, you know, I'm quite odd, quite eccentric, but something in me, my eye was drawn to footballers of balance, of elegance. And we had a little while ago with Tim Sherwood on this, and Tim encountered Sid at Blackburn. And I'm like a dog with a bone with a handful of footballers that Neil and the listeners to the beginning of you have heard me ask about time and time again, but Sid's only come up once before. I'll tell you what Tim said. He said one of the things, he said Sid could really drink, loved a night out. He said, but he was so smart. He said, because King Kenny was the coach then, he said, I watched Sid, and Sid was always downwind of Kenny the next day. Not just the polo mints or the spearmint gum. He always knew which way, and Kenny was like nose up twitching who's been drinking, and Sid would all. But we're talking about a footballer who went to Bari in Serie A at a time when Italian football wasn't simply
probably elite amongst Europe. It was hard. It was for the smart ones. Still, there was a little bit of a law of the jungle for defenders. I'd say it's not as bad as 60s, 70s. Tell us about the footballer that you connected with, and but also the guy, Sid.
Sid was just a diamond guy. I don't actually remember Sid saying anything bad about anybody, not even the opposition. But as a football player, he was just so good, so clever. I mean, left and right foot. You could have twisted them off, put them on the other side, and Sid would have been exactly the same.
I've never heard that in my life. That's a brilliant expression.
I'm telling you now, and talk about balance and a step ahead. Oh, Sid was miles. I mean, I think I'm right in saying Gordon Cowan's broke his leg for England and it kind of halted him. But he'd have got a bunch more caps had Sid never done that. For me as a football player, we used to always have this thing. He'd say, if I was going to come short to him, depending how far up the pitch he was, and I would come short, and I'd just spin, and he would just put it, and it would literally drop over my shoulder. It was like Tom Brady throwing a pass to Gronkowski. Beautiful. He's like, one hand, thanks very much, touchdown. Unbelievable. Sid could drop it right over the top. I can remember one particular goal. We played Queen's Park Rangers, and Dave Seaman was in goal, and he put the ball over the top, and as the ball bounced, he put that much spin on it, it actually hit my arm as it came back to me. And it dropped perfectly, and I volleyed it right into the corner. I didn't really have to move. It was brilliant. And as a man, listen, you say you like to drink. We used to go for a couple of pints, and he did like a pint, Sid. And I don't know where he put it, because I swear to God, he was four stone.
Like a greyhound.
Four stone. There was a pub in Lichfield we used to go to called the Shoulder of Mutton, just as you drive into Lichfield. I don't even know if it's still there. And we used to hide in the corner. And then his missus would come and pick him up and sit with her hand in the horn for 25 minutes until Sid would come out. Oh, he's so good. I mean, you think back, you're like, I'll just finish this. And you're like, Jesus. Sid, just go. Nah, she'll be fine.
Life was better then.
Life was better.
More colourful.
Yeah, I think so. Having said that, it sounds as though, you know, I'm being rather unprofessional. They're saying we went for a beer. I'm not saying this was a Thursday or a Friday. This may have been a Tuesday afternoon for an hour and a half. But and certainly not if we had a midweek game. But in terms of professionalism, I don't remember Gordon Cowan's turning up at 5 to 10 for training. But he'd be there at 8:15, you know, playing head tennis, you know, preparing properly and showing the kids, apprentices, what it is to be a football player. It's not just once you get there, you've still got to be professional. You've still got to do the right things. Because as soon as you don't, you drop a level, you drop a level, you drop a level, you disappear. Can't have that. But it was such a good time, Graham, and I was very fortunate. I've mentioned Mark Walters as well. Mark Walters, what a brilliant football player. And obviously Gary Thompson, who I just have the biggest affection for. He's a big man, used to just hang in the air and just win a header. And I was like, you know, when you watch something now, sometimes you think, why did you not anticipate that? You know he's favourite to win it. And even if he's not favourite to win it, you've got to anticipate. You've got to take a chance. And Tommy would go up, and I'm on my way. I'm on my way already, because I know he's not losing the header. And he was just brilliant. It was just, I mean, you're making me have a big smile on my face thinking about my time at Aston Villa, but it was absolutely brilliant. And of course, they still sing that daft song, Sphinxy and Butchie, and everybody goes, Alan McInally. It's just humbling at best, you know.
You earned it. You earned it. And I think as much as it makes the gives you goosebumps, that things like that, love expressed in song, and also Mickey taking for others expressed in song in football, is a part of our culture that's a wee bit gone. You know, we won't dally in this, but I remember a story that, you know, the Leeds side, we were talking, I think, to Joe Jordan, and Joe was talking back about wee Bobby Collins, and he talked about Joe wasn't in this side, obviously he wasn't, but when Leeds went to Anfield in about 68, 69 and needed to get a point or win to win a title, and they drew 0-0 at Anfield, and the cops stayed behind to sing about Leeds and applaud them. And we've all lost that culture a little bit, that need to express ourselves with wit and ingenuity. So when they shout Alan McInally at Villa Park, when we all get back to football, just lap it up. Before we've got a nice question coming up about Villa before we change subjects. So I have to ask you, you played with a couple of other characters. Did you one of my dearest friends and most loved. Did you have time with Tati Cooper at Villa?
Oh, Tati. How can I forget Tati Cooper? Neil Cooper to everybody else. Of course I did. He was injured when I got there, but he was just brilliant.
Most infectious man.
Football character. I mean, he had it in abundance. He had too much. And I always used to thought, God, it must have been Sir Alex Ferguson must have been chasing him round the up and down Union Street in Aberdeen for days on end. And
if you're ever a Marx Brothers fan, back then, Ty looked like Harpo Marx in them days. He didn't believe like Harpo because he used up all the words that Harpo never had.
The only thing he never had was that horn. If he'd that, that's exactly who he'd have been.
Funny, man. Our sponsors are Bet365, and you know Steve Freeth really well, and he is sitting, waiting like a little kid, for you to talk us through. Now, maybe you've forgotten this goal. It's Aston Villa against Millwall. And what's really special about it, I think, and I've got to hand the reins over at the pilot quickly, is that, if I'm not wrong, in coming up from Div 2 back to what's now the Premier League, it was you and Millwall, ding-dong battle all season. I think maybe they just nicked it towards the end. And in the first four games of the season, you score a bunch of goals, I think including the two at West Ham. You're on fire. You're like, aye, this is not only my level, I'm overdue being at this level. And it's Millwall. Now, I've set the scene, Al. Tell us what happens.
I didn't like Millwall back then because they were intimidating. And I mean intimidating. And that didn't really bother me, even with Celtic when we went to Kiev and everywhere else we went, there's intimidating places you go to, but Millwall's intimidating. But maybe the game he's talking about, the game was actually at Villa Park. And you had, I mean, you probably, you know, Teddy Sheringham and all that played in that team. And they had some...
It was Sheringham and Cascarino up front that day.
So I'm going to say Terry Hurlock played in that. And honestly, he was as hard as nails, wee Terry. Really. And they had a really wonderful football team. But they had... And Millwall obviously carried that reputation. But we'd played... I'm presuming Steve's talking about my goal of the season.
Correct.
Normally what happens, you try and say to kids, look, if you can take one touch and shoot, take it. If you don't need a touch, don't take it, have a shot. Your control, if you need two touches, take two touches, get away, get it back. Or if you can do things as quick as you possibly can, it doesn't let anybody else get into the game. So it's a free kick. Actually, Razor Ruddock, of course, there's another one. He scores a free kick straight into the top corner. Had Nigel Spink stretching all the way, Nigel couldn't get it straight in the top corner. And everybody's like, oh my God, what a goal. They have a free kick and it's punched out. So as the ball comes into the Villa box, Nigel comes out in amongst bodies and punches it to me about 20 yards outside the box. And the defender immediately backed off because he knows, A, if he gets close to me, I'm turning him. So already, when I watch it on the TV now, I'm like, the defender, instead of trying to do that with me, comes off of me and I turn and he's already on his way back. So I do him right away because I'm already up at half pace and I start to run. So I've had three touches of the ball, nick it past another and my touch is okay, but I know there's a defender coming from my right-hand side and I can see him flying in. And I'm getting faster and faster. And I know that I need to get there just to click it away from him because I know he's going to bring me down. And I kind of hurdle him, have another touch. Now I've got the goal that you beat. And I'm like, okay, you can't run 75 yards and then not stick in the back of the net. And I've had 9 touches at this point. And my last touch has to be a good one. And the goalie thinks I'm going to go that side. And I curl it round him and put it into the corner. And it's the goal of the season. I had 10 touches the ball without anybody touching it. And it's forever remembered as obviously a wonderful Villa goal. But when I look back, it really is genuinely satisfying. It was a great goal.
Three questions that generates. That goal in specific, but in general, when you're running at that pace and trying to beat men and end up in front of the goal, were you somebody who needed to look at the ball?
No, because you need to be aware of what's happening because you're either getting wiped out or you're going to have to be strong in the challenge. You know the ball's there. You're aware of the ball. When you touch the ball, you kind of look at it. But as soon as you do, you don't need to keep looking at the ball. You need to be aware of what's around about you. That's important. because you can't just run into somebody. So A, you need to have your head up. How many players do you see running with the ball and they've just got their head down? They're not seeing anything. You're not seeing the picture. So you've got to be a little bit cleverer. And certainly, you can look at the ball, but it's only fleeting. You must know where the ball is pretty much 94% of the time. But you need to be aware of everything else around about you.
Second question. You said that last touch was to get you away from the defender who's going to lunge in. But you wanted the ninth touch before the tenth, which is the shot for the goal, to be the right touch. You said it needed to be a good... What did you want to do, or generally, but that time too, with the night, what, if you are about, you know, my next thing I'm going to do is to shoot, what's the touch to put it away from your body, slightly to the right, dead in front of you, what distance, what was your last, your penultimate action?
I'm going to say my eighth touch takes me past the last defender. The ninth touch is steady, because I'm going so fast... I can't really come back to the centre, so I'm heading across the goal. So I need to almost keep it coming across the goal, because that's going to give me better angles. I can either go that side or I can go there. And my touch wasn't a very long one. And the ball slowed down, and I had to slow down quite quickly. But the goalkeeper had come so far out that he almost made it easy for me. But I still had to get enough curl in the ball to put the ball round, which I got it just a bit spot on. And then, obviously, the rest is history. But... It's trying to make an angle for myself to make sure I've got more than one option. That's the big thing.
The last one off this goal is an AB. Did you have a proper celebration planned? And what kind of noise did Villa Park make?
I'm trying to remember. It was still the first half. The place was buzzing. The place was absolutely buzzing. To be fair, apart from like Sid saying, typical you. I tell you, there was one great story from Gary Thompson. Tomo didn't play that night, and himself and a couple of other boys, I'm going to say Mark Lillis, you probably won't remember Mark Lillis. Mark had come to Villa, lovely guy.
Mark Lillis.
I think they were in the stand with the boxes at the back, you know, there's a glass boxes. And I think when I've scored the goal, Tomo's turned to somebody and went, "We're not playing in that team anymore." Basically, when I run the length of the park, and I got two goals that night. Actually, the other one was a belted as well. But I, you know, I can remember Tomo telling the story. They turned to one of the lads, going, "Well, that's that. We're not playing this team then. That's it. We may as well move," which I thought was really brilliant. But yeah, good times.
Thank you for listening to The Big Interview. It's produced by me, which sounds egotistical, but it's also true, Graham Hunter, and Backpage. Our music is by Beer Jacket, who else? Editing by Charlie McGarry. Thank you to our hosts at Acast and our loyal sponsors at Bet365. We're also supported by our socios. Find out how to become a socio, how to support us, at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. Here endeth the lesson.